You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
So this is the new way we're going to intro the podcast on Getting the Yes And. Is I actually just hung up with our guest today, Samir Hasija, who has a new book called The Phoenix Encounter Method, Lead Like Your Business is on Fire. And I think you're going to enjoy this. And it's really building on previous podcasts we've done about technology and the need for change and how COVID-19 is accelerating it. Samir is an associate professor of technology and operation management at INSEAD, which is a worldwide known business school. We were taping at midnight his time in Singapore. So I very much appreciate him staying up so late to talk to me, and I think you'll enjoy the podcast. Here you go.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking starts.
Samir Hasija, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
In the introduction to your new book, you write, quote, "If you're smelling smoke, there's good reason why. The business landscape is going up in flames around leaders everywhere," end quote. And I know this is certainly true now as we battle a global pandemic and social and cultural unrest and a variety of natural disasters. But I think you would posit that this was true before all those things happened in 2020.
Absolutely, Kelly. Thanks for having me here and bringing this up, because, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about, and we've been doing this for the last 3 to 4 years, actually, and the book has only come to its conclusion now, where, you know, we realized very quickly that as business leaders start to think about, you know, what lies ahead of them in the future, one of the biggest barriers that everybody faces is that we are, in some sense, prisoners of our own experience, which makes us think about, you know, what can I do better based on what I have learned from the past? Now, nothing wrong in that, but the problem is that invariably leads to incremental thinking, even for extremely smart people. And we know that from history, time and again, that big giants eventually go down. Big companies, big organizations eventually suffer a fate of mediocrity or even oblivion down the line. And it's because of the fact that they end up doing the same things again and again, perhaps incrementally better. That's not good enough. And your starting point was that this is never good enough, but today it is not good enough at all, right? And this is an irreversible trend where the pace of change, the need to change, and the need to do something dramatically different is only going to go up and not down.
You say that, quote, you need to become willing to periodically set fire to your own organization so it can rise again, which is the premise of the book. But that is not easy for many leaders to do.
Not only is it not easy, it is to some extent, how should I put it? It's almost like asking people to stop doing what is currently making them successful, which is counterintuitive. So it's difficult, but it's also something that's not easy to rally behind. However, time and again, we have seen that if you don't do that, then you are invariably, deciding a course of a path for the organization, which is going to go down. And so it's not easy, but if helped with a systematic process, the what we call as the Phoenix Encounter method, mm-hmm. we can guide you. We can help you go down this path in a way that, you're not going to eliminate resistance, but you're going to a large extent, reduce resistance. And my co-author on the book, Paddy, he always likes to say, to be forewarned is to be forearmed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes this easier, is that if you can see the light at the end of the tunnel, then the motivation and the inspiration is much higher than if somebody just came and told you that you need to undo what you're doing and do it differently. That's not going to happen unless you have an epiphany and the realization on your own. The Phoenix Encounter method helps leaders to have that epiphany.
So I'm going to assume you don't know a lot about improvisation, which is my field. But as I'm reading this book, and I hope this isn't obnoxious, there is so much alignment between improvisational philosophy, which maybe doesn't surprise you in the sense of what you would need to be able to react in the moment. One of the things you talk about is these different kinds of leaders. And you say, quote, leaders must learn to view their world from three very different perspectives, 50,000 feet, 50 feet, and 5 feet. And I immediately thought of a storytelling exercise that we do at Second City, which is called 60-30-10, where you have to tell your story in 60 seconds, in 30 seconds, in 10 seconds. So you have this ability to be fluid depending on the situation you're in. And while yours is a little bit different, I think they're aligned in some sense, and especially in the idea of the fluidity of, like, you're never staying in one place. You've got to be able to know all those different perspectives.
I'm so happy to hear, Kelly, that you really picked this up really well and you hit the nail on the head.
Right.
What is a common misconception when we talk about the leadership altitudes is that one altitude is better than the other. That operating at 50,000 is where the leader needs to be, or operating at 50. That is completely not true. What is true is for a leader to identify that they need to be able to operate at all three depending on the situation. Do I need to have the big picture view, the panoramic view of where the world is going so that I can figure out how to make sure that my organization is aligned with that? But then I need to be able to do it. And at the end of the day, I also need to think about myself and what am I as a person, as a leader, and am I the right person to lead this organization? And recognizing when to be at what level and seamlessly move between the levels, as you call it fluidity, is really important. Our observation, and we happen to be academics, so we're fortunate enough to interact with a lot of people on a fairly regular basis, business leaders from all over the world. We've observed that we find people, many of them operating at different levels and quite comfortably so. The issue that a lot of them have is, how do I move between these altitudes and do it depending on the need of the hour? That's a key skill that needs to be developed. And it's not easy, but it can be done.
So before we get into the method, I want to talk a bit about technology, because really, in terms of disruption, this is what's driving a lot of this. And it's interesting, the podcast recordings, like I didn't know when we were going to talk compared to others, but my last podcast interview just last week was with Mael Gavet, who wrote a new book called Trampled by Unicorns, which talks about both the incredible opportunities that tech has brought to the world, but equally, it presents significant dangers when it comes to things like privacy and equity. And you bring this up in the book, like, this is amazing what's happened and what is happening. And at the same time, and probably in fact, because it's so amazing, there's this tremendous dark side that the potential there that is probably also happening right now as well, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, again, a very important thing that leaders need to realize is that two things. Technology for the sake of technology is just a race to the bottom, right? So everybody can get automation and lower their costs. That's not the game. The question is, how are you using technology to allow you to change the game altogether, to change your business model, which then you need to think about, well, how technology could take down my business. Now, as you're doing that exercise of thinking about what can technology do to actually destroy your business, will be the first step to try and figure out how you can leverage technology to create the next version of your business. But it shouldn't stop there because of the second thing that you said, which is the unintended adverse consequences of technology. Well, as you're thinking about technology and using it, you don't just stop about how can it help me create the next version of your business. You can then do the next step to try and figure out, well, if I use technology to change my business model, how could I adversely affect all my stakeholders, including society, which is a stakeholder in every business, as it should be. Mm-hmm. And contemplating about those adverse effects and speaking with people who are different than you, who perhaps have a different perspective than you, and creating that panoramic view is going to be very, very important for every business leader. Because it is no longer acceptable to stand in front of the society and say, we did not know that this would happen. It's not good enough anymore. You should do your due diligence by actually trying to figure out what all can happen. Then you may still end up making a mistake, but at least you gave yourself a fighting chance of avoiding it.
Yeah, and we're big on diversity within ensembles at Second City, and recognizing, even you think about this in a sports metaphor, you're not going to have, you know, just like all center forwards or all goalies in your team. And the problem in Silicon Valley right now is just so male, so white, so Asian. And I mean, like 80%, I think, with the big four, big five. And what you do in these sessions, these encounters, is it's not just sort of diversity within. You also build on the evidence that outside voices can be incredibly useful for you to be innovative inside your company.
Absolutely. You need to have multiple perspectives that come from all sorts of individuals, people who think differently than we do, people who've had different experiences. I mean, my opening statement here was that your experience can be your trap, can be your prisoner. And you can't change or undo your experience, but you can learn from other people's experience, from their perspectives. Diversity is important, or inclusiveness is important, not just for lip service, which unfortunately I see a lot of. There's a lot of lip service to this issue. But you know what? This is not a social cause. You can be a right-wing, profit-maximizing capitalist. And trust me, you will benefit from inclusivity and benefit mm-hmm. from diversity. And so these are not orthogonal as the way the world has previously put. That's a complete myth. And those who realize it, and those who, well, the best time to realize it was yesterday, and the second best time is today, right? Yeah. So inclusivity is extremely important, because you will not know what you don't know unless somebody comes and makes you realize it. And that's where inclusivity and diversity help.
And before we get to the method too, I don't want to lose this story, because you mentioned your co-author, Patty, and there's a really wonderful account when he spent his Christmas break with his family in a small village on the west coast of India, and kind of made this discovery of how technology was reaching fishermen, correct?
That's absolutely right. And, you know, academics are often blamed of living in an ivory tower, right? Mm-hmm. And there's perhaps good reasons for that, good and bad reasons for that. And the beauty of INSEAD, and here I'll even throw a plug for INSEAD, the school that we work at, is that we're often, you know, as a standalone business school, we're deeply connected with business and society. Mm-hmm. And it, one main ingredient of our DNA is to constantly reach out and understand what is the world really doing, and how are they doing it, and why are they doing it. And these observations have, when coupled with academic rigor, have allowed us, and we're lucky enough to be in that position, have allowed us to hopefully understand things perhaps at a deeper level, at a level that we can then go back and inform executives and leaders on how they can do what they do. And Paddy's anecdotal story is a classic example of him, you know, out on a holiday speaking with these fishermen and understanding that they are using a device which people sitting in headquarter in Europe would perhaps never have imagined. Mm-hmm. So the beauty of understanding from customers that are perhaps not your traditional customers, people, markets that are not your traditional markets, geographies that are not your traditional geographies, but trying to understand what are the needs there, what are the pain points there, what are the aspirations there, what are the thought process there, can be an engine for value creation and ideation for any organization, no matter where you operate. So you know, putting on a stopper to a conversation that I don't want to hear about what's happening in Myanmar because we have no business in Myanmar and we'd never see ourselves going there in 10 years is perhaps an opportunity lost, even if you never go to Myanmar.
Yeah, and I think what was interesting to me about the use of cell phones, I mean, this is the smartphones, is there were multiple aspects that they were taking advantage of, right? It was both in terms of figuring out pricing, but then they were also using it as a location, like, right? There's sort of a GPS to spot where they laid their nets.
Absolutely, because, you know, if they didn't, because, you know, they go out deep sea, they don't have mm-hmm. fancy boats, okay? They put their nets out. And the biggest problem for them is when they come back and trying to collect their nets, they have to try and remember where they put them out. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy, no matter how experienced you are. You know, it's and again, they don't have the most sophisticated navigation systems on their boats, right? Mm-hmm. So it would take them a lot of time to collect their nets back, which means they couldn't put as many nets.
Yeah.
With these GPS-enabled phones, they were able to lock the location of every net that allowed them to put a lot more nets because they could collect it and come back by the time it was sunrise and then take their fish to the market. So this is a classic case of increase in productivity because of a technology which was not meant for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or I can't imagine that Nokia was thinking about them when they made these phones.
No, they were not thinking about the fishermen.
No.
So with the method, here's the thing I love, because I read so many of these business books, which are your 12-step to this, your, you know, that, and you come right out and say, quote, "We don't believe in magic." So this isn't about a magic formula. This is about evidence-based understandings of how human beings box themselves in really limit their own possibilities. And what's interesting to me about that, the podcast is called Yes And, which is around this improv principle, which is basically forces you when you're improvising to not say no, and actually don't even settle for yes, right? So the idea is, how do you get an abundance of ideas in a short period of time so that you can then move to your sort of analysis place? So I mean, the book is like the philosophy of Yes and the Phoenix idea are married in that, I believe.
Absolutely, Kelly. And just to add to that, one of the things that, you know, you talked about the method and the frameworks that many frameworks exist in the world of business and business books. But I just fundamentally believe that if there is a framework, an action plan that is going to tell me what the future is going to be or should be, then I just feel almost by definition it's an incorrect framework. Right. It's not going to be able to work, because if it's so easy to predict it, then I don't think we're talking about the future.
No.
There cannot be a framework. There has to be a process. There has to be a method to find your framework. And right. I think the framework is going to be different for everybody, right? So you're right. This is about discovery, self-discovery.
So I want you to talk about the opposites debate, because I find that this is a terrific way, and again, a not an easy thing for people to do, but you actually literally have sort of a framework for how you can engage in sort of what I call divergent thinking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, usually if I ask a business leader today, straight up, let's say I'm meeting a CEO of a bank and I say, listen, you've been with the bank for, you know, so many years, you're the captain of the ship. Why don't you write down your top 5 to 6 priorities? What do you think your bank should be doing in the next, you know, mid to long term future? And I'm sure they'll come up with a list, and everybody will come up with a list. Now, interestingly, Kelly, let's say I asked the same CEO. I said, you know what? Forget this list. Just tear it apart or put it aside for a minute. And I want you to imagine that you are now not with your bank. And I want you to imagine a way that you, knowing everything you know about this bank, are going to come up with a business model that is going to take your bank down.
Right.
And being insiders, this is where the debate starts coming in, and they start challenging their thinking. They're like, oh, I can create a model like this, and I can combine it with this technology and with that business model. And, oh, by the way, there's a proof of concept because somebody in the Philippines did this, and it was quite successful. So I'm going to borrow that idea, and I'm going to use this in New York, which is where my bank is based. What that suddenly does is it starts challenging every existing strategy that was written up front when I would have asked the CEO of what your strategy is. At the end of the workshop, if I ask the same CEO, can you write down what really should be your priorities going forward? What is remarkable, Kelly, I mean, we've done this with, I don't know, more than 1,500 executives. Actually, when we wrote the book, it was 1,500. Now it's even more than that. Wow. Every time we ask them to rewrite their strategy, it is remarkably different than they first wrote it down. Hmm. And that's what this viewpoint debate is. We want you to challenge status quo by imagining an unhinged destruction and what could completely come and take you out. That forces you to break down blinkered thinking and creates this dialogue, which then allows for a fresh perspective. Of course, you need analysis after that. You're not just going to use this dialogue and come up with new strategy. But this gives you a starting point that simply was not available had you not done this exercise.
We find in the very early improvisational classes when novices are coming in that we do more unlearning than we do learning in the beginning. There's an exercise called point and untell where we have people mm-hmm. point at an object and call it something it isn't. This is not easy, especially to continually do it. And so we're trying to make them aware that they are going to go to their anchors over and over and over again. And so we have to sort of remove that for them to get to, and this is the work that you cite around growth mindset and Danny Kahneman's work and Gary Klein. I mean, mm-hmm. it's trying to put in practice, this is a skill, which is very much what I appreciate about the book, which is like, no, this is a thing to be practiced over and over again. And by the way, you can't, it's not a one and done. You have to build it in as like a cultural habit for leaders, but really everyone inside an organization.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we've done, and this will, this will also come out very soon, is along with the book, we've also created a manual, mm-hmm. which is because, you know, you're absolutely right. This is a muscle training exercise. You can't do it once. You have to constantly keep at it. Otherwise, the muscle will atrophy. Mm-hmm. And it's going to disappear. So what you've done is you've also created a manual, like a guide, which is once you read the book, you get the idea of what you need to do. You understand the stories, you get motivated, you understand the philosophy, the underpinning behind it. And then the manual is meant to kind of be your playbook, so to speak, to be able to facilitate these processes in a repeated manner. We found of all the executives that we've done this with, they often come back to us, not only telling us that they've been doing it, but they come back to us to even share their results with us. We've written many of those stories down in the book, mm-hmm. And because we find them fascinating. And you know, you will not see these stories in popular press. Of course, we had to anonymize them because you don't want to give away trade secrets. So we anonymized all the stories, in fact. But the manual becomes a guide that kind of helps leaders to make sure that they can repeatedly do this, with the aim of ultimately making this a part of their organization's DNA. That this is just day to day. This is the way they operate, right? Where they're not going to accept things at face value. They're going to challenge it, try to go through the Phoenix Encounter process, and then see whether it still makes sense or not.
And you do cite some stories of companies like Sears, and we've heard that story before, and Dollar Shave Club on the other end. I'm endlessly fascinated about how the railroads screwed this up, and I want you to talk a little bit about. Theodore Levitt, he wrote in the Harvard Business Review in the 1960s about these railroad companies. What did they do wrong in that period, which was it was a very limited vision they had of what their business was?
I think so. And again, you know, to be fair, Kelly, I think we're also, you know, when we write about these stories, we are aware of the hindsight that we have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we are aware of it. We're not the typical, doing a hindsight analysis and then beating these executives down. At the same time, Kelly, I believe that somebody else's hindsight should be your foresight.
Sure.
Right. I mean, learning from the railroads is a classic example. They were not thinking about how the world is going to radically change, and how just within the transportation sector, how technology is going to shift the way people and goods can be moved around at a speed that was and a cost that was unimaginable to them. This is a very technology and economics driven play. Now, we can learn from that because the entire automotive sector is going through a second wave where, to some extent, I can now say that this is no longer hindsight, where I think they're being blindsided and they're not being careful in evaluating how the world of technology can change everything about the way they do business. And I'm not just talking about in the automotive sector, right? I mean, let's face it, some of the biggest innovations happening in transportation today are not coming from the automotive traditional players, right? So firms like Google and, the big tech companies, they now consider a car, for example, as a device. They're like, it's a commodity. What really is being sold and made money from is all the software that goes behind it, that mm-hmm. goes in it. And that's the one that is really going to be the one that makes some value or creates value of it, whereas the hardware part, the car part, is slowly and surely getting commoditized. And if I get out of passenger travel and look at supply chain and goods moving around or logistics as such, then have these companies carefully thought about 3D printing and a technology which, and I'm not talking about 3D printing being used to make trucks, I'm talking about 3D printing eliminating the need to move goods around the way we do today. And by the way, COVID, for amongst all things that we've seen, the one thing it has certainly done is re-questioned or asked people to re-question how much global movement of goods we have all over the world. And if that's going to go down, what's going to happen to the logistics industry? Do they have their eye on that ball? And are they thinking about it? And it's not clear to me if that is something in the horizon. Yes, they're thinking about the electrification. They're thinking about autonomous technology. But they should also be thinking about the global supply chain and how all of that is going to change, because that will have a huge impact on the world of logistics.
Yeah, I was just struck by the fact that you point out that Michelin is experimenting with a pay-per-mile business model. So you wouldn't be buying tires, you'd be...
In the new terminology for this, Kelly, I like this terminology. It's called X. You must have heard SaaS, software mm-hmm. as a service.
Yep.
So the new one is XaaS, which is everything as a service. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
And so the question is, can I sell whatever, I was selling a box in the past. Can I now sell a service that this box provides rather than the box itself? And by doing so, do I create some sort of competitive advantage for myself? Perhaps I get a larger market share because I'm able to make it more attractive to my customers because their capital expenditure is going down and now they're just going to use it on a service basis. And again, technology allows you to do that. I can't pay per mile for a tire if I don't have a chip inside the tire that is able to measure how much that tire is being driven around. And so the minute I have this kind of IoT or Internet of Things technology, which is able to track the actual movement of a tire, I can start billing based on that. Now, the beauty of this is I'm not advocating that this is a good idea for Michelin.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that Michelin now has the ability to experiment and see whether this is a good idea or not. And that is the beauty of forward thinking. That's the beauty of trying to do these things. By the way, on a side note, this is not only a way to capture they're a bigger share of the market because perhaps you're reducing the cost of ownership for your customers. This is a way that now, because the tire is owned by Michelin is getting all sorts of data that the tire is now generating, which allows Michelin to create this company called Michelin Solutions, which is now a consulting company which provides all sorts of tire related consulting to their customers. So freight operators, if you want to lower your fuel costs, I have so much information on how your drivers are using your tires that I can give you some information that can perhaps be used by you to optimize your fuel costs. And that's not trivial either, right? So So it opens up new avenues of services that you can provide. It allows you to capture a larger market share and hopefully experiment and see whether it's the right thing to do or not, right? So to me, it's quite fascinating. And by the way, Kelly, to be fair, this is not new, right? Mm. Xerox has done it, you know, decades ago where they said, you know what? We don't have to sell photocopies or photocopiers. We can sell photocopies. So why do I have to sell the machine? I'm just going to bill based on the number of photocopies that the machine is being used to produce. So the idea is not new, but technology allows the same idea to be used in industries where previously it was not being used, right? And in that sense, it's quite valuable.
I think it's interesting too, when you talk about data, you know, we immediately go to the Amazons, the Apples, the, you know, for good reason, but you cite in the book that actually there is just loads of data in these legacy companies, but they're just not using it. They don't know how to access it.
They don't. And quite often they're not set up to use it. They in terms of their technology, the way their systems are created, the architecture. They're also not set up in terms of their organizational design because they're siloed to a large extent. And, you know, they're so siloed that, you know, one arm may not even know what the other arm is doing or knows, and that communication is missing. And these silos need to be broken. But, you know, again, you've said this a couple of times today, it's easier said than done.
Yeah.
And in order to force these organizations to realize how debilitating these silos are in their ability to reinvent themselves. Again, we believe the encounter is very, very powerful because the encounter forces them to see how an unconstrained adversary can take them out. And the only way they can defend themselves is by breaking these silos and doing something about it. And that call for action, that building of that burning platform, to me is very important for legacy organizations to overcome this inertia of breaking these silos. Because, you know, every leader out there would admittedly say, yes, we are siloed and we want to break it. But when it comes to ground reality, it's not so easily done unless everybody is on the same program. So the method is not only a way to generate ideas, the method is only not only a way to give you a glimpse of what the next version of your organization can look like. This method is also a good way of getting everybody on the same program, to get everybody in the organization motivated that it's time we did something. Otherwise, it's going to be lights off, not so far away in the future. So it's a good motivational tool as well.
In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast. But before we do that, we're recording this on a day where WeChat is very much in the news in my country for a variety of reasons. And you, in the chapter on platforms, you talk about sort of this like tremendous thing that the WeChat platform has become, which I don't know that everyone knows about how many different aspects of people's lives are centered around WeChat. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, this may sound as a little bit of exaggeration, but I have checked with many of my Chinese friends and colleagues. WeChat to a person living in China is the same as internet to a person living in the US.
Wow.
That is the level of penetration and importance that WeChat has now created. And for a lack of a better word, there was a nice New York Times documentary on it. And I think they used a nice analogy. They said it's like a Swiss Army knife. Mm-hmm. Basically, it can do everything for you. And because it's been doing everything, now life is getting centered around it. Now, there is obviously a problem with that as well, because now you become too big and too important. And suddenly, you're almost acting like a monopoly. And there's something that needs to be thought about when it comes to that. But certainly in China, they do have competition. At least they have competition from Alibaba, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, the super apps have been created because the way they think and the way they do business is just different. They realize that their growth exists from the power of networks, the economies of scope and scale that they generate. And through this economies of scope and scale, they generate so much data and information that then they can creatively monetize in various ways, including creation of new services and new products. Now, what is interesting here, Kelly, is to realize that one of the reasons they were able to do it in China and now also in Asia, and not just WeChat, there are many copycat versions of WeChat, is because many of the businesses here, especially the SMEs, the small and medium enterprises, including even the end users, the customers, they were frustrated. They had a lot of pain points because overall business and ease of doing business was not there, right? Like there were infrastructure gaps. So many of the features that these apps created were plugging in holes and gaps that existed in the existing infrastructure. And that allowed them to create a dominant position because they were plugging these gaps and then people got used to them and now they are the dominant player. We haven't seen this in the US because in general, the infrastructure has been quite good. So there wasn't a place for a super app, so to speak, to come in and start plugging because there weren't many gaps to plug in. I'll give you a small example. Think about payment systems. Like, you know, we know Ant Financial, this whole IPO, this huge IPO that they're going to go through. You know, Ant Financial was set up. The history goes back to this company trying to do e-commerce, but they realized that payment systems were so old school that they were not able to do e-commerce unless somebody fixed the payment systems in China. But the banks were not interested in doing that. So they said, you know what, we will do it. Now, Amazon does not have that strong a payment system because they were not trying to fix that already existed in the US, right? Mm-hmm. Payment systems were quite well set up. So they didn't feel the need to do it and hence they didn't do it. So there was a little bit of a, but it's quite interesting, right? That means that these companies were always looking ahead and trying to figure out what problems to solve and how to make sure that our customers are more and more engaged with us. And that became one of the big kind of success factors for them and created arguably now one of the biggest firms in the world. So that's kind of their history, but there's something that we can learn from their history, right? And see how it applies to our markets.
We had Jim McKelvey on the podcast who co-founded Square. And he very much he uses a lot of art metaphors. He's a glass blower but it's a very similar thing of like, how do you disrupt? How do you find these things? You have to think outside the box. And, you know, Square found that problem with small, when people were going, it was him. He was trying to sell a piece of art. And they were just getting charged like crazy. So it's fun now for me to go into my local store here and Square is so kind of fun and beautiful and quick. And it just found this sort of niche market in the small, which is also interesting, right? Because everyone tries to think about where can I hit in the big.
Yeah. And the pandemic is also another big awakening. I mean, we can compare and, you know, we can compare the China and let's say we can compare the West. And, you know, we all went through lockdowns. But we know the Chinese were able to handle the lockdowns in a way that was quite interesting. And they were able to do it because they were infrastructurally now set up. Their e-commerce platforms were set up. And they were set up in such a way that overnight, mom and pop stores were able to get onto these platforms. So even though the world had locked down for them, their business was able to sustain itself because they were able to, almost like a switch, move from a brick and mortar operation to a digital operation. And we were unable to do that in the Western parts of the world. Of course, we're going to quickly learn, and I'm pretty sure going forward, that's going to be the way to do business. Yeah. But because we were not set up to make that immediate switch. But now, as we speak, everybody has realized, and we are beginning to create those systems so that we don't have to go through this again, that we are able to switch from our current, the analog world to a digital world overnight, rather than actually spend years and millions. The Chinese were able to do it at a click of a button.
So the way we end the podcast is we ask our guest for a yes and story, a moment in their life work where they normally would have said no, but they didn't stop at yes. They said yes and.
Yes. Since you marked it down, can I make it personal?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So thanks for this question, Kelly. And the yes and story for me is a personal story. It's because I'm a faculty in a group at INSEAD called Technology and Operations Management. Mm-hmm. And the Phoenix Encounter method came from a yes and story for us, you know, where me and two of my colleagues, my co-authors, Ian and Paddy, we were sitting down. And Ian, he's the director of the Advanced Management Program at INSEAD, which is a very senior program for our executive education portfolio. And he said, Samir, Paddy, I have a challenge for you guys. You know, what would be an interesting way to talk about technology to really, really senior executives who come from legacy businesses, who may not be technology forward? And, you know, we discussed and he says, you know, isn't technology all about facts? It's a fact, right? This is what technology can do. But in a training environment, in an executive development environment, we want to discuss concepts. So what is the concept? And can we discuss concepts about technology with executives in a way that makes a difference to the C-suite? And that was a yes and moment for us, where I said, yes, we can. And the way to do it is to make them imagine how technology can completely change the way their world is working right now. And that was the birth, in some sense, of the Phoenix Encounter method, where we started envisioning how technology can be used in combination with society, with business models, with emerging markets, with innovation, with all sorts of things, and how that can completely change the way the current game is being played. So much so that if we as a leader are not able to keep up with that, we would become redundant and our organizations would be forgotten. So that was our yes and moment, and that's how this book got created.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because you use such vivid language in the book, a lot of war metaphors, and of course the Phoenix thing, because you need to have them feel it. And the way we feel it is through story, through character, and these fables that are as old as time. But you know, it's a dance in the C-suite, right? Because it's like they don't want to necessarily talk about the storytelling, but we know that that's the way you're going to get to them.
Absolutely, Kelly. Because at the end of the day, for us as academics and as writers of the book, the biggest reward that we can see at the end of the day is when leaders and organizations all over the world, all sorts of industries, start using the Phoenix Encounter method, the analogy, the language, the narrative, to actually change and change the game and reinvent their businesses, reinvent themselves, hopefully in a way that is sustainable, hopefully in a way that creates value, hopefully in a way that makes them progressive and forward-looking as opposed to firefighting all the time.
The book is called The Phoenix Encounter Method, Lead Like Your Business is on Fire. Samir, thank you for coming on the show.
Okay, it's a pleasure, and I appreciate having this chat with you.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.